think talent exists, your ability to measure it and predict it is not very good. And I would love for somebody to show me data that suggests the opposite, because we've never found a team that was able to do this at a standard that they expected they were able to.
Welcome to Sport Intelligence, the Canadian Perspective, a podcast brought to you by the Sport Information Resource Center, or SIRC. I'm your host, Paula Baker, and in this show, you'll get an all-access pass to the inner workings of Canada's vibrant sports sector, where we'll get into the untold stories and hidden dynamics that shape Canadian sport, from groundbreaking research to the strategies that drive our teams and athletes forward. For our very first episode, we're going to be looking at something that can play a role in how we understand athlete development and talent identification in sports. So, there are some athletes who don't make a big splash early in their careers and yet still end up excelling later. This can often be referred to as sleepers, and it can present a unique challenge for scouts and coaches. How can they predict future success when current performance doesn't always tell the full story? To help us unpack this, we have a very special guest today, Dr. Joe Baker. He's a professor at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Kinesiology and Physical Education, and for over two decades, Joe's research program has explored the factors affecting athlete development and performance, and he is recognized as a world leader in the science of talent identification and development. Needless to say, we have an expert in the house to help us better understand this topic. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Oh, for me too. I'm looking forward to the chat.
So to kick things off, let's talk about these sleepers in sports. Sleepers are considered to be athletes who underperform early in their careers, but then later exceed expectations. Would that be considered correct?
Yeah, I think so. I would even maybe broaden the group a little bit more than that. Just anybody who has the potential for some future success that either is currently underperforming or isn't in the system at all.
And just as an explainer for our listeners, when you refer to the system, it means the sports system. So now that that's out of the way, we can jump into what specific traits or behaviors distinguish sleeper athletes from their peers who were, say, drafted earlier or who show promise earlier.
It could be any number of things, right? It could be the fact that their performance is a little lower than their peers that they're being compared against. If you look at them from a team selection or a talent identification perspective, they might look like they're less talented, but the reality is for a lot of these athletes, if you let them stay in the system, they'll develop into the same kind of performer. They eventually catch up. Or it could be that the kinds of characteristics and the kinds of things that we see during their early development are not the kinds of things that we think are relevant for future development. And for us, that's the root of the problem, right? The idea that we think we can see future talent in early development and we choose athletes based on those expectations that we have.
That's the thing. It's something that you hear a lot about, but it's not something that's widely researched or studied. Is that correct?
I think so. We've started to look at it, but if you look at the field of research as a whole, we know so little about early athletes' engagement in the athlete development pathway. And most of what we do know has been looking at success stories and tracking them backwards instead of athletes who are currently in the system and tracking them forwards. It sounds easy to do, but it's a much more complicated thing to try to track them forwards than it is to look at the success stories and figure out what they did that worked.
Yeah, scouts and coaches are under a lot of pressure to identify future talent early on. So in your research, what have you found about the limitations of predicting long-term success based on current performance? Why is it hard to forecast who will thrive at higher levels of competition?
I think there's a number of things. And what our research has shown is just how monstrously complicated that task is. And the reality is we ask coaches and recruiters and scouts and administrators to make that decision all the time because we don't give them enough resources to keep everyone in the system, whether that's facility resources or coach education. You know, there's only so many elite high performance or knowledgeable coaches to go around. So the system kind of forces these decisions on the people that are responsible for delivering it. What our research shows is when we put people in this challenging position, the decisions that they have to make are generally not very good. And that could be because they're not educated enough to make those decisions. It could be because the biases they have are interfering with the accuracy of those decisions, or it could be just the thing that we're trying to predict is so monstrously complicated that we shouldn't do it in the first place. And so it doesn't matter which one of those is the root cause of the challenge. The reality is we should try to avoid this as much as possible whenever possible.
Yeah, that's interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking, like, you mentioned examples, and I was going to ask, what's the percentage of athletes that end up being high performance? And they're like, oh, heck, he was a sleeper and we didn't know.
We could probably come up with a percentage, but I would be hesitant to sort of hang my hat on it, because any percentage that we come up with is still the people that were able to stay involved and engaged in the system. And the majority of them, if you think back to your own experience in sport, most people, when they get cut from a team early on, they don't stay in the system. And so it's really tough to come up with a number.
Not everybody's a Michael Jordan that gets cut from his high school team and then still ends up being one of the best NBA players in the world.
Well, and there are certain athletes, and coaches will know this, there are certain athletes where you give them that sort of negative assessment and it's like a fuel for them to prove you wrong. But those athletes are the rarity. Most people, if we think about general models of motivation, when you don't get feedback about your competence, you don't normally stay in the activity. You move on to another one where you can get that feedback.
Is there an example that you can give of a sleeper that is well known?
Michael Jordan's probably the best known one in North America. I think Lionel Messi is a good example of not so much a sleeper, but somebody who defied expectations of what he looked like early on. He was one of the smallest players on his team when he was developing. And so for him to become the absolute generational player that he's become, I don't think many people would have predicted that.
I'm just going to hit pause here for our listeners. I want to highlight a few things as it relates to some sleeper success stories in professional sports. Now, Joe's already mentioned Michael Jordan as one. Next up, Tom Brady. He was drafted 199th overall in the 2000 NFL draft. He was then dismissed as a long shot with limited physical attributes, but 7 Super Bowl rings later, he's the undisputed king of the quarterback position. Steve Nash, great Canadian athlete, only one college scholarship offer came his way. And from that, he was drafted to the Phoenix Suns, of which the fans booed when he was drafted. But Nash turned doubters into believers, earning 2 NBA MVPs and becoming one of basketball's greatest point guards. Kurt Warner, another quarterback, he went from stocking grocery store shelves to winning a Super Bowl and earning 2 NFL MVP awards. Undrafted and underestimated, Warner's journey from the Arena Football League to NFL stardom is definitely one for the books. And then Randy Johnson, early in his baseball career as a pitcher, control issues plagued him, making him a risky prospect. But his perseverance paid off. He became a 5-time Cy Young Award winner and a World Series MVP. And that pretty much solidified his place in baseball history. And that's it for my little pause. Back to the podcast. Now, I'm curious about how this idea of sleepers fits into what we know about athlete learning. Are there common characteristics or patterns that can help us identify these athletes who may not perform well early on, but later succeed? How can coaches adapt their approach to account for these differences?
I think there's a couple of big questions that could help us form strategies in that area. One is, why are they sleeping? And that could be their maturation is delayed. Maybe they haven't had the same opportunities for skill development. Maybe their support system isn't the same as players that seem to be overperforming compared to them at the moment. And then the second question is, how do we wake them up? And certainly, we wouldn't wake them up by removing them from the system, which seems to be what happens most of the time. Our strategy is to put this in the real world. As long as we can, we should be trying to maintain as many athletes as we can.
I like the way you say wake them up. To me, I think it takes a village, right? It's not just the athlete having the gumption or having the commitment or the mental fortitude to push through.
And the reality is, when we look at especially young kids in the system, it seems to be wired in us to look at the way they're behaving now and assume that's the way they're always going to behave. But the reality is, we have no idea of the relevance of that behavior a player has on the field at this moment and its relevance 10 years from now when we want to see them peaking as an adult.
You've talked about the understanding of long-term athlete development, and you've already touched on this, and maybe you can hone in on it, which is, how does focusing too much on early success or the the here and now impact the way we nurture talent in Canada's sports sector?
It's one of these tough questions in sport. And I think we have a tendency to assume that these are either simple questions or have simple answers. And the reality is the way that we develop athletes and the kinds of environments that athletes need to acquire skills in sport are some of the most complicated learning environments that we design for humans. I would be hesitant to say, you know, do this because it's always going to work, because there's a lot of nuance and a lot of art in figuring out what that person in front of you needs in order to continue to thrive. And the thing that they'll need tomorrow is not the thing that they're going to need a month from now or a year from now. But what we do know is if you do anything, if you have a coaching strategy or an administrative policy that is going to undermine that engagement, then you have a policy that's not as effective as it could be. Because anything we do to undermine engagement is going to ultimately lead to a less efficient system.
Can you talk a little bit more about the nuances and the art to it?
The overwhelming sort of movement that we've seen in the last decade or two decades is to try to figure out how we can intensify the early types of training that young athletes are getting in their training environment. And I would say that's the exact opposite approach that we should be taking. We should be figuring out what does a developing 7-year-old or 9-year-old or 13-year-old or 17-year-old, what are the things that are unique in terms of the learning environments they need to be able to thrive? Let's not try to figure out how we make their learning environments more adult-like. Let's figure out exactly what they need as a 13-year-old or a 17-year-old that is a unique constraint on their learning, and match the training environments that we create to the learning and developmental needs of the person in front of us, instead of assuming that they all need to train like Tiger Woods does now. It's no, what did he do when he was a 4-year-old that made him want to swing a golf club for the next 30 years? That's the billion-dollar question.
Now, looking ahead, is there any promising research or research development or like new technologies that could help us better predict and support long-term athlete development, especially when it comes to identifying sleepers?
I think there's a lot of discussion, maybe not as much policy or administrative change that we'd like to see at the moment, but there's a lot of discussion about new ways of thinking about athlete development. So the idea of talent transfer is really an idea that looks at how do we help athletes transition from one sport where they might not be best suited to success to another sport where those skills could be used to better effect. For me, I think those are more focused on what the challenge is, which is how do we design a way to keep them involved for as long as possible and provide them with the flexibility and adaptability to be able to move if they're in the wrong pathway. Right now, I think our pathways have become so specific that it's really challenging for an athlete to make those kinds of moves. And the reality is most of them will get to a point where they figure out, I'm not going to the Olympics. I'm not going to be a professional hockey player. Well, now what do I do? Because we have a system that is so rigid and so inflexible that there is nowhere for them to go.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is there support for them to actually even look at transferring to another sport? Because my uneducated guess would be no.
You're absolutely right in most cases.
So then what advice would you give to coaches and teams who would, for all intents and purposes, want to ensure they're not overlooking anyone?
I think that when we have discussions with coaches, we almost always start with, I'm here to convince you that your talent selection decisions are almost always wrong. And here's how we make sure they have as little impact on the athlete in front of you as possible. And part of that is helping them to make better decisions. Part of that is getting them to think about the feedback they give to that athlete when they cut them from a team. Because the reality is, if there's only 20 spots on a team, we can't give you 21. So that's not an answer. But we can help you deliver that message to your athletes in a better way, in a more thoughtful and caring way, so that it doesn't have the impact of the sort of binary way we think about talent.
You know, you've been working in this field for a while. Have you seen anything shift?
Yes, we have. And it's progressive countries that are driving that shift. So we do a lot of work with Australia at the moment, and they're very focused on increasing the efficiency of their system. We have to move away from this idea that just because we have a system that seems to work in certain areas every 4 years, that we can't create one that's better. We can't always be striving for improvement. And that's what I like about working with the Australian system, is they're always chasing that next developmental improvement for their system.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about Australia's, what are they doing that's maybe considered groundbreaking or fashion forward in this area?
Yeah, you can say they're really the thought leaders on this sort of 21st century approach to talent identification and athlete development. They started it going into the Sydney Games way back when, because they have the 2032 Games coming up. And the thing that's fascinating about them is how progressive and thoughtful they are in the strategies that they're starting to put in place to be able to maximize their chances of success in those Olympics. The Queensland Academy of Sport that we work with, they have what they call a talent search, but it's not your typical sort of RBC training ground search where you bring athletes in, they do a battery of tests. What the QAS is doing is they're jumping in cars and they're going out to areas of the state that there is no high performance program. These are kids that wouldn't be seen by high performance development coaches. And what's the power of just giving them an opportunity to show what they can do? And what's the power of identifying a kid and giving them the resources and training facilities they need for 3 months? How much better could they get? Is that a better way of thinking about talent management and identification and transfer than this idea that it's just a simple algorithm that we need to plunk variables into? No, it's a development that you're trying to facilitate and nourish. I think that's such a progressive way of thinking about a really complicated problem. The other area where we see a lot of change is in the Paralympic sports, because they have a completely different set of constraints on athlete development. And so for them, it makes more sense to adopt a resource sharing approach to athlete development than this sort of really rigid siloed approach that a lot of sports in Canada have.
That's absolutely brilliant. So looking beyond youth sports, and your research does include masters athletes, how might their stories inform how we think about talent and performance across the lifespan?
It's a really interesting question. I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of it, because we have to think that the people that are in seniorhood now, especially the later decades of the lifespan, they grew up in a completely different sports system, a completely different way of thinking about health and physical activity than the current generation, who are going to turn into senior citizens if everything goes well. So the constraints and the knowledge that those populations have are completely different. And so when I look at the people that are active as master athletes now, they didn't come from a sport development system that was overly focused on talent identification. They came on one where sport was something you did because it was fun, because it was social, because it was enjoyable. And I wonder whether we're undermining that sort of future development in people that are going to become seniors by making sport less enjoyable and too stressful and too focused on high performance at the cost of participation. I don't know how we blend all of those things and still create high performance athletes, but I think putting them as if they're two separate outcomes is not the solution.
That's interesting, yeah. And also the monetization of sport, I mean, that's just changed.
Absolutely.
And you're listening to Sport Intelligence, the Canadian Perspective, CIRC's new podcast where we explore the forces that drive Canadian sports from the inside out. I'm your host, Paula Baker, and today we're joined by Dr. Joe Baker, a leading expert in athlete development from the University of Toronto, and we're talking about sleepers, athletes who outperform later in their careers despite their earlier performances. To what extent do psychological factors like motivation, confidence, or adaptability play a role in an athlete who was potentially a sleeper?
When we talk to high performance groups and professional groups, that is the elephant in the room, is how do we help a person develop those characteristics? Because we know those are big difference makers at the end of the pathway. The challenge is we don't really understand the way to nurture and develop those capabilities in young people, because nobody comes with those kinds of things hardwired in their system, a sense of competence, a sense of self-esteem, the coping resources to manage the intense pressure that a high performer needs to figure out how to manage. We know they need those at the end of the journey, but how do we provide them with the opportunities and experiences to develop those on their own? We can't give them to them. It has to come from within. And I think that relates back to the comment that I made before. If we really understood what a developing 9-year-old needs, in order to flourish, in order to thrive. We would design a system for that person to thrive instead of thinking about how do we make their practice as intense as possible. It probably has nothing to do with practice intensity and more to do with development of coping skills or the opportunities to demonstrate resilience. Those types of things that change a 9-year-old into a capable adult.
There's also so many variables there because the touch point isn't just a coach or their teammate.
Right. It's an ecosystem.
Now, I know when we were chatting earlier, we talked about that one study that distinct eye movements were a key factor in identifying sleepers. How does gaze behavior contribute to talent ID?
Yeah, and I think that study was Dan Fortin-Guichard's study, right? So Dan's a postdoc in our lab, and he did this amazing project to show and reinforce a lot of the things that we're talking about, right? If we gave athletes opportunities, sleepers would become high performers, but most of the time we remove the opportunity for that to even happen. I think the gaze behavior stuff is just reflective of the fact that most of the time when we think about what athletes need, we focus on demonstration of technical skill or physical capacities, and we very rarely think about what their brain is doing. But if you think about sports like ice hockey or soccer or basketball, a lot of the differences at the high performance level are cognitive, not physical. Height, for example, in the NBA doesn't predict a single performance metric. And it's not because height isn't important. It's because they're homogeneous for height. Everybody is tall. And so where is their variability? Well, there's variability in decision-making. There's variability in cognition and anticipation. And that's the kind of thing that you can measure with eye tracking stuff. You get indicators of what's called the quiet eye, which is stability of your gaze. There's a number of hypotheses for why this occurs, but it seems to be related to better performance. Stronger performers, more successful performers are ones that have more stable gaze as they're executing an aiming task.
And do coaches just know this off the top of their head or?
Most of the time, no. But if you think about what's the most basic instruction that a coach ever gives a kid when they're learning to catch, keep your eye on the ball, right? Which is, that's a stabilization of gaze instruction. And so it's not totally removed. And it's one of the reasons why when we have these discussions with coaches, they often come away feeling empowered because they're either getting reinforcement for something that they figured out how to do just organically, or we've given them some tools that they can make small little tweaks in the way that they deliver their coaching that could have pretty important and powerful effects.
What's one key takeaway that you'd like our listeners, whether they're athletes, coaches, or sports enthusiasts, to remember about the unpredictability of talent and the importance of looking beyond current performance?
I think if I was to have a part A and a part B in my response, I would say part A is to just recognize how monstrously complicated predicting a person's future is. And whether that we're talking about athletes or our own kids or whatever, predicting every choice that person's going to make in every environment that they're going to have from when you see them now to that outcome that you're trying to predict is monstrously complicated. And our best mathematical models are incapable of capturing that complexity. And so it doesn't make sense that we would expect our coaches to be able to do that. And then the part B is, with that in mind, until we see a radically different sports system, we're still going to have to make selection decisions about athletes. And so can we do that in a more caring and thoughtful way based on the idea that the people you're probably going to cut are the ones that are actually very well suited for future success.
Your book, The Tyranny of Talent, I always found that one super interesting because I think there's the subtitle of your book suggests that we should ignore talent. And so what does that mean in practice? How can this approach lead to better outcomes in sport?
This is another sort of pet peeve that we have in our lab is the use of this word. We're basically split down the middle that half of the lab thinks that we should throw that word out altogether. And the other half thinks that we just need to do a better job of explaining what it means.
Where do you fall? Which side of the lab?
I'm on the explain what it means side because I think we've got over 100 years of research in this area that could help us use that word better. And the reason I think we should use it is because if you don't use it and you set up a situation where you're promoting that everybody has equal opportunities for success, then when somebody isn't successful, you put the blame for that solely on the shoulders of that individual, when in fact it could be they didn't have the same opportunity for success because of their biology. And right from the beginning, they didn't have that likelihood of success. That doesn't mean they can't enjoy the sport. It doesn't mean we can't create a system for them to thrive and continue to acquire their skill, but it's not realistic to expect that they're going to make it at an Olympic level or a professional level. I think that's variability between individuals is just a reality. But I think that a more fruitful approach for coaches would be, even if you think talent exists, your ability to measure it and predict it is not very good. And I would love for somebody to show me data that suggests the opposite, because we've never found a team that was able to do this at a standard that they expected they were able to. And so let's focus more on creating learning environments and development environments for the people in our care to thrive. And if we do that, our high performers are going to still develop into high performers, but the other people are going to get something much more positive from their experience as well.
Is there anything that keeps you up at night regarding sleeper talent or talent ID, but in particular sleeper talent?
Nothing that keeps me up at night, because I think word is getting out and very busy talking to groups that want to talk about this. And whether that's countries like Australia or the UK or on the podium here in Canada, or professional teams basically around the world, word is getting out that we need to come up with a way of redesigning athlete development pathways. If there's anything that keeps me up, it's that I don't have another 5 hours in the day to actually get as much done as I would like. We need people thinking about complicated issues in complicated ways. And a lot of the stuff we're seeing in sport is too simple, at least in my opinion.
Well, needless to say, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us today. And thank you so much for being part of our first episode. I think it's such an interesting topic, and I'm jealous of the work that you get to do.
Thanks, Paula. I feel very lucky to be able to do what I do.
And that wraps up the first episode of Sport Intelligence, the Canadian Perspective. I'm Paula Baker, and I want to thank you for joining us as we take a closer look at the hidden dynamics shaping Canadian sport. Information on Joe's book, The Tyranny of Talent, and other additional resources about his work on talent identification and acquisition can be found in our episode show notes and on CERC's new website, CERC.ca. And if you have any questions or comments, do not hesitate to reach out to us on social media at CERC_Canada on Instagram or at CERC_Tweets on X. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like or subscribe so you don't miss out on any upcoming conversations with some of the brightest minds in the sports sector. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.